It's really good to be with you again tonight, and I hope our time together is meaningful for you and meaningful for me. A couple words of background here. About 10 years ago, Tom McFall and I became partners, so we co-authored what is now 3 published books. This has been a real growth experience for me, and I've learned so much from that partnership, and I audaciously suggest that maybe Tom has picked up a nugget or two along the line. Tom and I have presented twice before Kerygma, and in one series we summarized the themes in our first book. In the second series we summarized the themes in our second book. And this November, this is the 4th of 5 presentations about the themes in our third book. I have found you to be a really special group. It looks to me like you are thoughtful, well-read, well-traveled. You ask good questions, engage in meaningful dialogue. So it's a pleasure to share this time with you. So the title of our third book is Christianity and Evolutionary Pluralism. And tonight, we're going to focus on 2 main things tonight. The first one is, how is modern science related to world religions? Think of St. Augustine and the 2 books analogy, which Walt has summarized for you in a previous Kerygma presentation here. Then I'm going to share with you 10 open questions for modern science, or you can think of those as 10 dirty little secrets here. So these are 2 previous books, God is Here to Stay. If you go to Amazon and enter God is Here to Stay in a search field, our book will be the first hit. Same thing for the second book, God and Randomness. The first hit will be our second book here. And I'm proud of these 2 books, and it's been a pleasure to work with Tom. This is a slide from last week here, and showing a world map, of course. You're all cosmopolitan people here, but this shows the distribution of the main world religions across the globe here. And Christianity represents about 32% of the world's population, number one, and then there are other ones, Islam here in green, and others. Hinduism here. Here's another slide from last week here. This is a summary of world religious diversity here. And this slide tries to capture some of the main ideas of each of the main world religions here. So in this section here, we've got monotheism, which includes us, Christianity, down here in the subcategory of Abrahamic religions, which also include Judaism and Islam. And over here in pantheism and animism, we have Hinduism, Taoism, Sikhism, Shinto, and traditional Chinese religions here. Over here, we've got a special group of spiritual atheism, including Buddhism and Jainism. And then if you even include the non-spiritual materialism, that takes us to atheism and agnosticism or uncertainty here. These religions, including atheism and agnosticism, are related to each other through the universal reciprocity norm, or the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, and the search for the ultimate. Now there's another way to think of these world religions. And if you look at this simple little table here, so this column right here represents many gods, or polytheism, as the ultimate spiritual reality. And this column over here represents one god, or monotheism, as the ultimate spiritual reality. Here we are over here in Christianity. This row represents God or gods is embedded in nature, or immanent is the key word for that. And this row here represents God or gods as outside of nature or transcendent. So now, so that's like a little background, a little connection with last week and the week before. So now what I want to do is try to convince you to at least lean in the direction that modern science is kind of connected to Christianity here. And so the first part here is, if we look at, this is the first slide of two slides here. So if we look at modern science in terms of the discoveries that have been made, this is just a very simple cursory look at a few of the discoveries that have been made since 1900. The first one I want to point out is the start of our universe within the Big Bang here. And this is an amazing, amazing idea here, a completely incomprehensible and highly non-intuitive. Our whole universe, it is assumed, was at one time, at the beginning, was infinitely hot, infinitely small, and had infinitely high pressure. All the mass energy of what we now see in our universe was contained in that one singularity. And that means all space, all time were confined there. The Big Bang occurred, we think, about 13.8 billion years ago. Billion years, incomprehensible length of time here. And it is roughly 92 light years, billion light years across here. One light year is incomprehensible. So if you have 92 billion light years, this is 92 is, by the way, a very soft number. I mean, it might be 120 or it might be 80 or something like that. It's so we don't really know. But this is one guess. Since a light year itself is completely incomprehensible, if you go out, if you take one beam of light and shoot it from the sun out to the orbit of Pluto and then back again, one round trip is about 10 hours, 10 light hours. So that distance in itself is incomprehensible. So if you go out to the edge, to one light year, that's way beyond our ability to comprehend. So 92 billion is like way, 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 way beyond. Another issue, another discovery in modern science are the natural laws. If you look at the natural laws, gravity, the strong force, the weak force, and other associated natural laws that describe the world we live in, what you find is an internal kind of beauty and elegance. And another amazing thing is that these natural laws are discoverable and they seem to be constant over time. When astronomers look into deep space, all indications are that the same natural laws that we have on the surface of Earth apply out in space as far as you can look and determine that. And the natural laws are useful for predictions and understanding the world we live in. Now, if our universe was due to random, unguided processes, you certainly would not expect this kind of beauty and discoverable nature of our natural laws. So I claim this is non-intuitive and indicative, I contend, of a designer here. Okay, this little bracket here is a little reminder for me to tell you a little story about a thought experiment. Let's engage in a thought experiment now. Let's imagine the 10 best philosophers in the country, most wide-read, most intelligent. All 10 of them belong to the National Academy of Philosophers. That would be analogous to the National Academy of Sciences, which actually does exist. And let's say that these 10 philosophers are sitting in their comfy leather chairs in a library. And they were discussing the nature of reality here. Okay. I want to point out that this would be in a library, not a laboratory here. I contend that that group of philosophers discussing continuously 24/7 for the next 100 years would never come up with these two conclusions that we get from natural science. So how did we get to these conclusions? The answer is it's based on measurements, empirical evidence. It's based on simulations, based on natural law, and it's based on experimentation here. Another very important discovery in modern science since 1900 is quantum mechanics. Walt summarized this for you. And by the way, I thought Walt's summaries on religion and science were all very good. I attended most of them. And that was a really good set of presentations there. I just want to point out in quantum mechanics, which has to do with the very small, if you go down to 1 nanometer, which is 1 10 to the ninth minus 9 meters, so it's 1 divided by 1 billion times 1 meter, really small. A human hair, by the way, is about 10 microns, or I'm sorry, 70 microns in diameter there, which is a micron is a millionth of a meter here, just to give you some scale. So it's way smaller than the diameter of a human hair. I want to give you 3 quotes here about quantum mechanics. Murray Gell-Mann, discoverer of quarks, quantum mechanics is, quote, mysterious and confusing. Roger Penrose, an opinion leading physicist, quantum mechanics makes most sense. Richard Feynman, my favorite here on this list, Nobel Prize in quantum physics, actually quantum electrodynamics, is quoted as saying, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics here. Again, these were, quantum mechanics was developed and we now understand it based on empirical evidence. Quantum mechanics is essential for the electronics that we use, our iPhones, iPads, navigation systems in our cars, the imaging systems that are used in hospitals. And also quantum mechanics is important for us to understand the processes in the sun, how the sun works and produces radiant energy. I'll say a little more about that when we get to the 10 dirty little secrets. We also have a standard model for subatomic particles. Walt did show you this on a previous presentation. This has been very successful. The most recent prediction out of this model was for the Higgs field, which has the Higgs boson as a particle associated with that field, which was discovered in 2012. And such simplicity is unexpected. So, what conclusions can we reach? These are my suggested conclusions for your consideration tonight here. We have complete incomprehensibleness and non-intuitive nature here. If we compare that, we've already seen this in the discoveries of science since 1900. Over on the Christianity side, we say, I contend that that's kind of associated with God is a greater than the universe and a structure and randomness. There's a structure and randomness to the universe. When we see an elegance, beauty, discoverable, constant over time, space, and useful for predictions and understanding in modern science, I claim that that is pretty close to God's love for us and our love for each other, the universal reciprocity norm. When we see mysterious and confusing, such as in quantum mechanics and modern science, I claim that that's pretty close to over on the Christianity side and all world religion side, actually, the problem of evil, God's role in the pandemic, randomness, and in Christianity, the Trinity, which I would think is pretty mysterious. When we see simplicity, that's similar to over in Christianity side, prayer, salvation in the afterlife, and caring for each other, and ethical justice. So here are my conclusions about attempting to connect modern science and Christianity. These similarities are not proofs, but evidences, I contend, that there are links between Christianity and modern science. This reminds me of the two books analogy that Walt made for us from St. Augustine. Two ways to understand reality. We have material scientific, which would be like book one, and we have spiritual and religious. This is like book two. You see this is really an important analogy here, I think, because the thought processes, the way to process information, the way of thinking and so forth is fundamentally different in some ways over on the material scientific side compared to the theological, philosophical, religious side here in book two. So my question for your consideration tonight is, how can we say that only one book, book one or book two, but not both, exclusively provides the only access to reality? My conclusion is that both books are needed, and that world religions are embedded in this two book reality. Now, 2 weeks ago in my presentation, the second of five presentations here, we talked a lot about some Christian evangelical reactions to modern science, especially evolution here. And I wanted to just take a briefly summarize these three reactions. YEC stands for Young Earth Creationism. OEC stands for Old Earth Creationism. IDC stands for Intelligent Design Creationism. All three of these have some level of rejection of modern science. So if you are challenging, you know, modern science as a way to understand reality, then this means that ultimately you need to question the enormous advances in our standard of living, the advances in our healthcare, and the understanding of the universe we live in. So Tom and I are advocating for a position here where there is an overlap between modern science and there is a mutual consistency and support between modern science and Christianity. And Tom will have more to say about that next week. Okay, so that was part one of my presentation tonight. Now let's go on to part two, which is, where is the mystery in this knowledge machine of modern science? 10 unanswered questions or 10 dirty little secrets. So the first unanswered question in modern science is, how did life start on Earth some 3.8 billion years ago? And the real answer is, there is no conclusive proof. There are about seven proposed hypotheses now about how that started, such as panspermia, that life was came here on meteors and asteroids and deposited on the Earth. Another one has to do with life got started in underwater deep sea vents, which are warm, and that the energy source from the heat there could be used to support life. And there are others. There's another theory from Miller back in 1953, who did an experiment to try to simulate the early Earth about 3.8 billion years ago in a chemistry lab, and found that there were amino acids, the basic building blocks of proteins and life, occurred in that experiment. So, but the real answer is, there is no conclusive answer. And one reason is, little is known about the environment. We don't know about that far ago, long ago, just after We had a big bombardment just after the earth was formed. We don't know what the temperature is, what the rainfall was like, the acidity of the atmosphere, the energy sources, such as solar radiation, heat from underwater vents. We don't know the chemistry and the storminess of the atmosphere. So there's no definitive results. It's nearly impossible to develop an explanation or hypothesis when so little is known about the initial conditions, the molecular possibilities, especially the genetic codes that have to do with this, and the energy sources. Scientific American has called this the number one unresolved question in science today. So let's move on. What is dark matter? My guess is most people have heard the term dark matter. So here's the basic issue with dark matter. Something's wrong with the galaxies. Here's a bunch of galaxies you see down here. The problem is, if you look at these stars on the outer edge of the galaxies here, they're rotating too fast, okay? We understand gravity, and we understand that gravity is best explained by general relativity, but there's not enough gravity in this galaxy for these stars to be rotating so fast out here. If gravity only existed the way we currently understand, then these stars on the outer edge of that galaxy there would fly off into space, and the galaxy would not be this big here. So the conclusion here is that there's some extra gravity must be holding these stars to the galaxies. Most scientists call this, it's due to dark matter. Dark matter, what dark matter really means is we don't know what it is. So think of it this way. When you go to your primary care physician and you say, hey doc, what's wrong with me? And the doctor comes back, well, Al, you've got a virus. That's really a code word in medicine for, I don't know what's wrong with you. So that's kind of like what dark matter is. The third issue here, unanswerable question now, is why is the expansion of the universe accelerating? In 2011, just 9 years ago, a $1.5 million Nobel Prize in physics was given to three American astronomers. And what was their contribution? The contribution was that the universe is expanding here as we go along. So which is completely unexpected. The reason it's unexpected is because gravity is only an attractive force that we knew of nothing that could be pushing it out, causing this expansion of the universe. But it's not only expanding, it's the expansion is accelerating. So they hypothesized that the existence of a new energy in the universe, this is mysterious dark energy. Dark energy, again, like dark matter, is a placeholder for something we really don't know. So right now, the theory right now is that 69% of the mass energy of the whole universe consists of dark energy, and we don't understand it. I've got a telephone here that will now be silenced. So here's another unanswered question here. Now, you guys all have to promise me you're not going to tell anybody this later on after this presentation, and I gave you all these 10 dirty little secrets. So, for example, if you encounter Neil deGrasse Tyson, for example, who is an excellent writer and cosmologist here. If you encounter him, don't tell him I gave you this information here, or anybody else who's a cosmologist. Here's the issue. We've got ordinary matter and antimatter. Ordinary matter is the stuff you and I are familiar with all day long. Antimatter is something else. The current scientific understanding antimatter, by the way, is a when antimatter and matter come in contact, all of the mass is converted into energy. So it'd be a huge like explosion here. So down here, here's a little example. Here's an example of a hydrogen atom. Here's the electron going around here. Actually, the electron doesn't go around. There's actually probability distributions around here. Here's the proton nucleus of the hydrogen atom consisting of two quarks and a strong energy particle. On the antimatter side, the electron, the antimatter equivalent of the electron is a positron. And then you have these three other internal particles similar to these three inside the antiproton here. So the current scientific understanding is that in the Big Bang, for every billion antiparticles, there must have been a billion plus one ordinary particles. So the implication is that everything in the universe that we see, galaxies, stars, planets, humans, and baseballs, which are all ordinary matter, exist because of that slight surplus of ordinary matter over antimatter. So why is there so much more ordinary matter compared to antimatter when the expectation is there should be approximately equal amounts in our current theory? The answer to that question is, we don't know. So here is the unanswered question number five. And this gets down, this is pretty much similar to the big questions that we introduced you to a couple, 3 weeks ago. Before the 1960s, and that means going all the way back to Aristotle, the universe was thought to be in a steady state. This universe is isotropic. What that means is every direction you look in, and if you go way back in the stars into deep space and keep going, the universe will continue on forever, and it always was that way, and it always will continue to be that way. That idea is called the steady state, and it means it always existed the way we observe it, and it always will continue to mean to exist. In 1978, there was a very important Nobel Prize awarded to Penzias and Wilson. Okay, what they found, and by the way, this was an experimental discovery, not a philosophical discovery, that there was a cosmic microwave background, CMB for short. And what this implied, based on our knowledge of how particles work and how the Big Bang must have. This was a major.
Thank you.
We've got somebody's with a mic that's open here. I'll be down in a minute here. A major support for the Big Bang and a rejection for the steady state. So based on dark energy and accelerated expansion of the universe, ultimately the enlarged universe will become cold, lifeless, and dark. That's the current expectation now. However, I would contend, and this is this sentence I added here. However, since we do not know what dark energy is, we really do not know what the ultimate fate of the universe will be. The sixth unanswered question, does every big galaxy have a central black hole? Based on observations, mostly from the Hubble Space Telescope in the 1990s, astronomers observed that black holes exist at the centers of most galaxies, including our own Milky Way. But of course, you know, there's like 100 plus billion galaxies in the universe, probably a lot more. We don't know if they all do. So the answer is we don't know if they all contain a black hole. Here's a nice artist's rendition, which I got off of the NASA website, showing a black hole in the center of this galaxy here. I'm sorry, this is the black hole, and this is the material that's spiraling into the black hole, and it's drawing material from a nearby star here. It's drawing in here. And these energy sources are thought to be the radiation sources from quasars. Is there life in other parts of the universe? The answer is, we don't know. We have only one planet. The thing to think about on this question is, our universe is so vast, as we've already mentioned, 92 billion light years wide, 13.8 billion light years, years old, 125 billion galaxies. Each galaxy has got about 100 billion stars. Currently, there are 4,197 exoplanets that have been discovered. So to say our current ability to explore all these galaxies and solar systems is limited would be a monumental understatement. Also, life as complex as giant redwood trees, whales, roses, amoeba, eagles, dogs, and cats are likely to be rare compared to extraterrestrial life forms that we might eventually detect. Another big question that we humans have been wondering about for at least 200,000 years since we've been around is, what will happen to human life on Earth? And the answer to that question is, the eventual outcome will likely depend on the sun. The assumption here is that human life does not self-destruct beforehand, which is a pretty big assumption. In about, our current understanding is that in about 4 billion years, the sun is expected to enlarge and incinerate the planets of Mercury and Venus. Currently, Mercury is the closest planet to the sun. Venus is the next closest, and the third rock from the sun is Earth. And this incineration might possibly include the Earth. We have made observations of stars similar to the sun. Also, our current theories, confirmed by observations, give us an awareness of what happens, for example, at the subatomic level, how the sun produces its energy from thermonuclear fusion, the role gravity plays, and the pathways for energy to migrate from the sun's core to its surface, and then out from the surface to illuminate all the planets, including Earth. And all these observations and theories are consistent with each other. The ninth unanswered question is, does inflation theory govern the universe? Okay, I'd like you to draw your attention to this little drawing down here, which I also got off NASA. And this is a summary three-dimensional plot representing the universe, both in time and in space. So here is creation, or the Big Bang here, along the axis of this diagram here. Think of that as time. And what happened is, right after the Big Bang, almost immediately after the Big Bang, there was an expansion of the universe called inflation. This is different from an explosion. In explosion, you got parts coming off at all, in all directions, and they're lumps and some tiny particles and so forth. Well, inflation is like, it's like an uncontrolled expansion of the universe that occurred. And when it ended right about here, the universe was about the size of a basketball. And then, because this was still very hot, we come to the cosmic microwave background, which is represented here, which was about 380,000 years after the Big Bang here. Then there were the dark ages. It took a while for atoms to form and for gravity to bring together clouds of hydrogen and other gases here, and then there was enough gravity that thermonuclear fusion started to occur and ignite the stars here, and then the galaxy started to form. So this whole outside surface of the represented here, think of that as like the outside of a bell housing here. That's what it looks like. In 1981, Alan Guth, MIT professor, proposed a solution for some of the remaining issues from the Big Bang. just after Big Bang, the infinitesimally small singularity inflated but not exploded to become the size of a basketball. All observations confirm that inflation did in fact happen. So the answer to this question, does inflation theory govern the universe? The answer is probably yes, but there are significant unknowns that still remain. For example, what caused inflation in the first place? What was the energy source for inflation? Why did it stop when it did? Are there serious gaps? Let's see, let me minimize this. Okay, that brings us to the last dirty little secret or unanswered question is, do we live in multiple universes? Okay, so I want to draw your attention down here to this illustration down here. Let's say that this bubble here represents our universe. You're all the galaxies inside. So could it be possible that there are other universes outside of ours that exist in, you know, if you think 92 billion light years is unimaginable, well, the fact that there might be other galaxies beyond that is like really unimaginable. So since 1990s, there have been some modern scientists who have begun to consider the possibility there might be other universes besides our own. Currently, there is no direct evidence for multiple universes, no observations. Well, how would you do an observation like that? So if this is our universe here, and it's 92 billion light years across, and it's beyond our threshold to see, which it would be, how would you even be able to detect a neighboring universe? Okay, there might be some ways to do that. So for example, if you had a neighboring universe here, and this is our universe here, there might be gravitational or general relativistic effects that might redistribute the matter in some of the galaxies in some preferred way so that the galaxies would not be so isotropically distributed around our universe, and same thing here. But there are other possibilities too. Some of them have to do with quantum mechanics and the extension of these quantum mechanical fields like the Higgs field that might extend beyond our universe into this one. That's the current theory. So the jury, I would say that the jury is still out on that. However, there are several strong theoretical arguments for having multiple universes. However, I would just like to remind you that there have been many strong theories in the past, such as a steady state universe, that haven't worked out so well when additional observations have been made. Given the self-correcting and counterintuitive nature of many of modern science's most significant discoveries, the answer is possibly, do we live in multiple universes? Okay, that was my last slide. It's time for dialogue.